What did it mean to be a wife in the ancient world? How did Christian views change that meaning? What was the nature of marriage in early America, and how has that changed? These are just a few of the questions Eileen Dugan raises with her guest this week, Marilyn Yalom.
What does it mean to be a wife? Depending on whom you talk to in what period of history, she can be one's better half, the weaker vessel, a daughter of Eve, a helpmeet, a life partner, or one's significant other. The concept of the wife has evolved over the millennia, along with the institution of marriage itself. That is not to say, however, that change has always been for the better for the wife. How have Western definitions, perceptions, and expectations of the wife changed through the ages? And what is the future of the wife in the 21st century? With us today to explore the ever-changing world of the wife is Professor Marilyn Yalom, senior scholar at the Institute for Women and Gender at Stanford University. Dr. Yalom is the author of the recent book, The History of the Wife. Welcome, Dr. Yalom.
Hello.
Why did you choose to write about the wife in this work and not marriage in general?
Well, that's a rather unusual situation in that I did start writing about the couple, and it was just too big a subject. Finally, when I was talking to an editor, she said, why don't you just slice it in half and focus on the wife? That'll be a little bit more handy and manageable. So that's what I did, but I didn't forget the couple. I've now edited with Laura Karstensen at Stanford a collection of essays by various hands on the couple, and that's called Inside the American Couple.
What did it mean to be a wife in the ancient world, for example?
Well, for the most part, it meant being a possession, first of one's father, then of one's husband. And the wife was literally given or gifted by the father to the groom. That changed over time, say between early biblical times and early Greece, over a period of 1,000 years to the time of the Romans and particularly the Roman Empire, to a more egalitarian situation. But the wife was at best a junior partner, as she is still today to some extent.
Actually, how did marriage in the ancient world establish some of the problems and the nature of being a wife that we see today?
Well, one little trace of the gifting of the wife, which was ritual in ancient Greece, is that still today in the marriage ceremony, one says, who gives this woman? And the father stands up and says, I give this woman as my daughter-in-law in her own marriage. But also, the father said, and she gives herself of her own free will. So that, of course, was a great change from the Romans. But the laws changed. Roman law made a difference because it focused upon and insisted upon the consent of the bride and groom instead of simply the consent of the father of the bride and the groom.
Since there was gifting involved, so to speak, was there any possibility for affection in ancient marriages?
It's interesting that the Romans use the term affection legally, and in fact a binding marriage was based upon the notion of the intent of affection. We do certainly have examples of affection between husband and wife, but it was expected to grow after marriage rather than before it. So that was the basic difference from today, when we expect to fall in love and then marry someone of our own choice. Then you were given somebody to love, so to speak.
You've already mentioned the legal aspects of marriage in the ancient world. What about adultery and divorce? How are they treated in the ancient world?
Adultery was a female crime, so to speak. Certainly that was true in the Bible, because the husband had the right to sleep with women other than his wife, She could be a slave, she could be a concubine, she could be a second wife in biblical times. Polygamy was certainly allowed, whereas only the wife was considered an adulteress, and she could be stoned to death, as she is still, unfortunately, in some parts of the world. I'm thinking here, of course, of the Hebrew Bible, and one of the major differences with the New Testament is that the husband was expected to be monogamous as well as the wife, and there was a more compassionate attitude towards the adulteress. Of course, we are all familiar with the expression, let he who is without guilt cast the first stone. And this was paralleled in some ways in ancient Greece and Rome. Adultery was condemned much more heavily if it were the wife who was at fault. As far as divorce is concerned, usually in the Greek and Roman world, it was only the men who initiated divorce. But in later Roman times, women as well as men had the right to initiate divorce.
How would you describe the position of the wife and the nature of marriage in Western Europe during the Middle Ages?
During the Middle Ages, the church took over control of marriage. And it did two things. First, it pressured people to marry in the presence not only of a witness, but also of a priest, and to perform that ceremony at church. And second, it downplayed the need for the consent of the parent and foregrounded the will of the intended spouses. And this was a doctrine that had been around since the time of the Romans, but it became more prominent and even revolutionary from the Middle Ages on.
And what happened with the Protestant Reformation? You point to that as being a very important time for the history of the wife.
Yes, it is an important time. When Luther decided to take a wife, the former nun, Katharina von Bora, he established the model of a pastoral family. And marriage was elevated at least to the level of celibacy. And I think we have to remember that the medieval church celebrated celibacy. That was the top. To be an abstinent person was more considered more virtuous than to be married. And one of the things that changed during the Protestant Reformation is that marriage was considered at least as valuable as celibacy. So that is one thing. Another thing is that the wife began to be seen more and more as the spiritual equal of her husband. Now, this didn't mean that she had the same rights that he had. He was still the head of the household. She was expected to be subservient to him.
But in terms of salvation, she would be his equal.
Exactly. Yep. In terms of salvation, she would be his equal, and she was even expected to sometimes lead the way.
Okay, and moving on to early America, what was the nature of being a wife in early America?
In early America, following the Protestant tradition, the wife was indeed subservient to her husband. She was in this country, particularly in New England, which was more or less a theocracy. She was expected to be silent in church, not to make herself too visible, but she also was respected as a wife, and some took on the role of a partial preacher, even having gatherings at their home for Bible readings. So one can't say anything simple about the wife in early America. she was still having, on average, 7 children, so at least. So that kept her pretty busy right into midlife.
One of the most interesting parts of your book, I thought, was your discussion of the new woman and the woman question. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. We're jumping way ahead from the 17th century to the late 19th century. And we've gone through a period of great change because, to backtrack just a little bit from the new woman, remember that love began to be the primary criterion for choosing a spouse, even 100 years earlier, about after the American Revolution. And by the end of the 19th century, in America as in Europe, there was something akin to our women's liberation movement of the late 20th century. Women were encouraged to seek greater autonomy for themselves, not only within marriage, but outside of marriage. When we look back to those revolutionaries of the second half of the 19th century and the end of the 19th century, it's amazing to see the things that they were asking for. I mean, you've got to remember that in the 19th century, a woman did not own what she earned. Her earnings went to her husband. And one of the first things that and we have to call them revolutionaries, or at least reformists, people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, were pressing was the Married Women's Property Act, which would allow women to have their own earnings and to hold on to property that they brought with them into the marriage. So that was one of the first great thrusts of what we would call women's liberation, or at least progress for women. And that law, the Women's Property Act, passed in New York in 1860 and in various other states during the second half of the 19th century. So that by the time we come to 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, we're seeing women who are beginning to have a sense of their own autonomy, independence. This is a time when the women's colleges are being founded in the United States, colleges such as my own, Wellesley College, Smith, Vassar, others. This is the time in Europe when the woman question, as it was called, is being debated all through particularly Northern Europe. And some of you are, of course, familiar with Ibsen's play, The Doll's House. This expresses exactly the kind of concerns that people, and I'm not just saying women, but people were having. Did a wife have to remain a doll in her husband's house? A lot of people were saying no. And of course, concomitant with that were new opportunities for women to earn a living. Even professions like journalism or illustrating or secretaries were, well, I shouldn't say secretaries because most early secretaries were men, but there were, of course, teachers. That had always been a traditional job for women. But there were new opportunities for women, and these would continue all through the 20th century.
Actually, how does the position of the wife change in the course of the 20th century, especially after World War II?
Well, that's the second big revolution for women. It began, how far back? Certainly it got a new thrust with World War II, when women entered the workplace as they hadn't before. And not only unmarried women, but also married women, and married women with children, and older women. And this changed the possibilities for women. They didn't have to stay within a marriage that was an unhappy marriage if they could earn their own livings. So more women went into the workplace, and we began to see the beginnings of an increase in divorce. After the war, of course, in the 50s, there was backlash, as there almost always is when women make progress, when we were living at a time in the 50s when the birth rate shot up again. Now, the birth rate had been about, let's say 3.5 per white woman in 1900. It had been going down, and then in the 50s it shot up to, again, to around 4 babies per wife. There was a real attempt to keep women in the home once the men supposedly, the men had come back from the war and things were supposed to go back to normal. But they never really did. There was a slowing down of the process, but women continued to go into the workforce. The divorce rate continued to rise. In 1946, it was about 1 in 4. By the 60s, it was closer to 30%, if I have my statistics correct. And, of course, today it's 50% in the United States, roughly. That is, 1 out of 2 marriages will end in divorce. And then all the big changes that began to take place in the late 60s and 70s with a conscious women's liberation movement. I haven't mentioned contraception. That certainly has been a major issue in limiting the number of children, so that we are now talking about 2 children per wife or per mother in this country. That means that women who now live on average, let's say statistics speak about 80 years, that means that with only 2 children, one isn't going to spend one's entire life bearing children and taking care of them. This will be, maybe a quarter or a third of one's life. So that's a big difference. And, of course, the fact that at least 60% of married women with children are working today, and another 20% will move in and out of the workforce, and only about 10% will stay home permanently with their children. This is a very different picture of what a wife is today.
We only have just a moment, but perhaps you could tell us what you think it might be the future of the wife.
Well, I wrote at the end of my book, A History of the Wife, that I believe marriage will be one of many alternatives, not marrying, marrying later, divorce, serial marriage, and that to be a wife will be a vocation requiring the same kind of devotion that was once expected only of celibate monks and nuns. There are good reasons for one to marry, and there are good reasons for one to remain in marriage lifelong. But for better or for worse, I believe that that lifelong marriage is going to constitute less than 50% of marriages in the future.
Oh, thank you very much, Professor Yalom.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Professor Marilyn Yalom, senior scholar at the Institute for Women and Gender at Stanford University and author of The History of the Wife.